It's silly to rely on them whenever it's easy to test them. A-B testing is child simple in principle. Create a procedure you want to examine, generate a control condition, flip a coin to see who or what gets which treatment, and see what happens. A difference found using a randomized design establishes that something about the manipulation of the independent variable has a causal influence on the dependent variable. A difference found by using correlational methods can't guarantee that the independent variable actually exerts an effect on the dependent variable. Correlational designs are weak because the researcher hasn't assigned the cases to their condition. For example, lots of homework versus little, radio ads versus circulars, high income versus low income. If you don't randomly assign cases, people or animals or agricultural plots, to a condition, you invite on board all kinds of uncertainties. Cases at one level of the independent variable may differ from those at another level in any number of ways, some of which can be identified and some of which can't. Any of the measured variables or variables not measured or even conceived of could be producing the effect rather than the independent variable of interest. And it might even be that the variable presumed to be dependent is actually producing differences in the variable presumed to be the independent one. The greater the number of cases, people, agricultural plots, and so on, the greater the likelihood that you'll find a real effect, and the lower the likelihood that you will find an effect that isn't there. If a difference is shown by a statistical test of some sort to be of such a magnitude that it would occur less than one time in 20 by chance, we say it's significant at the 0.05 level. Without such a test, we often can't know whether an effect should be considered real. When you assign each case to all of the possible treatments, your design is more sensitive. That is to say, a difference of a given magnitude found by a within design is more likely to be statistically significant when tested in a between design. That's because all the possible differences between any two cases have been controlled away, leaving only the treatment difference as the possible cause of the relationship. It's crucial to consider whether the cases you're examining, people in the case of research on humans, could influence one another. Whenever a given case might have influenced other cases, such that any one case could have had an impact on other cases, there's a lack of statistical independence. N is the number of cases that can't influence one another. Classroom A has an N not of the number of children in it, but of just one. An exception would exist if influence could safely be considered to be minimal or non-existent, such as when students take an exam in a room with cubicles where there is no talking. Chapter 10. Experiments natural and experiments proper. Since newborns have immature immune systems, every effort should be made to minimize their contact with bacteria and viruses that cause diseases. From Germ Fighting Tips for a Healthy Baby, CNN TV News, February 2, 2011. CNN 2011. Infants who come into contact with a wide range of bacteria very early in life appear to be at a lower risk of developing allergies later in life. From Infants' Exposure to Germs Linked to Lower Allergy Risk, Canadian TV News, November 3, 2011, CTV 2011. Friends, colleagues, and the media bombard us with advice about how to live our lives and conduct our professional activities. Last decade, we learned that fat in the diet should be minimized. Now we're told that moderate quantities of fat are good for us. Last year's report maintaining that vitamin B6 supplements improve mood and cognitive function in the elderly is contradicted by this year's advice that it has no value for either outcome. 15 years ago, a glass of red wine a day was supposed to be good for cardiovascular health. 8 years ago, alcohol in any form did the same thing. Last week, we're back to just red wine again. Even if we're willing to default to accepting whatever is the latest medical advice, we have to reckon with conflicts between claims. Cousin Jennifer's dentist recommends twice daily flossing, and your own dentist advises that occasional flossing is adequate. The New York Times' financial advice writer tells you to dump stocks and buy bonds. The Wall Street Journal's guest columnist's advice is to buy real estate and park a lot of money in cash. Your financial advisor recommends a heavy allocation to commodities. Your friend Jake's financial advisor urges shifting funds from domestic to foreign stocks. Your friends Eloise and Max are extremely anxious about getting their child into the best possible pre-K childcare at whatever cost. Your friends Earl and Mike think that the stimulation their toddler gets at home renders outside intellectual stimulation superfluous and are concerned only about a pleasant play environment. This chapter gives tips about how to appraise scientific evidence presented in the media and proffered by acquaintances, and it makes suggestions about how to collect and assess evidence for yourself. You'll also read about how disastrous it can be when societies decide to rely on assumptions about the effects of interventions rather than conducting experiments about their effects. A continuum of convincingness. So you watched CNN in February and they told you to keep your baby away from germs. Then you watched CTV in November and they told you the germs were good for your baby because they decreased the likelihood of autoimmune diseases such as allergies. Whom should you believe? What kind of evidence would make you choose to expose your baby to germs, and what kind would make you inclined to keep your baby as far away from germs as possible? Here are some natural experiments you might find helpful in answering this question. A natural experiment allows a comparison between two, or among several, cases that are generally similar, but differ in some way that might be related to an outcome variable of interest. No one manipulates that possibly relevant difference. If that were the case, it would be a genuine experiment. At the same time, at least we have no reason to assume that cases differ in some way that would render comparison meaningless. Suppose you knew that East Germans were less likely to have allergies than West Germans. Suppose you knew that Russians were less likely to have allergies than Finns. Suppose you knew that farmers were less likely to have allergies than city dwellers. Suppose you knew that children who had attended daycare were less likely to have allergies than children who didn't. Suppose you knew that children who had pets when they were infants were less likely to have allergies than children who didn't. Suppose you knew that children who had lots of diarrhea as infants were less likely to have allergies than children who had less diarrhea. Suppose you knew that infants who were born vaginally were less likely to have allergies than infants who were born by cesarean section. As it happens, all those things are true. These natural experiments resemble true experiments in that similar cases happen to differ in some particular way, the independent variable, in effect, that might cause a difference in the outcome in question, the dependent variable of allergy. Each of the natural experiments provides a test of the hypothesis that early exposure to bacteria confers resistance to allergy, as well as to other autoimmune diseases such as asthma. Autoimmune diseases are an abnormal, mistakenly protective overreaction against substances normally present in the body, in which white blood cells attack actual body tissues. Allergies range from annoying to debilitating in their effects, and asthma can be lots worse than that. Every day in the United States, tens of thousands of kids miss school because of asthma, hundreds of people enter the hospital because of it, and some people die of it. We can assume that East Germany and Russia are less hygienic places than West Germany and Finland, or at least were in the not-too-distant past. Interestingly, many years ago, a Polish immigrant to the United States told me, half-jokingly, that he thought allergies were an American invention. He may have been onto something. We can also assume that children raised on farms are more likely to be exposed to a wide variety of bacteria than children who grow up in cities. We know that children with pets are exposed to a wider range of bacteria, including fecal bacteria, than those who don't have pets. We know that toddlers are walking petri dishes who expose one another to a wider range of bacteria in pre-K programs than they would encounter if they just stayed at home. Lots of diarrhea can be the result of exposure to lots of bacteria. Vaginal birth exposes the infant to the full panoply of bacteria in the mother's vagina. These natural experiments all support the conclusion that bacteria are good for babies. I doubt that these findings would encourage you to let your baby get down and dirty, to be exposed even to the yuckiest kind of bacteria associated with mucus and animal feces. But what if you knew that swabs of babies' rectums that revealed a large variety of bacteria predicted lower autoimmune deficiency at the age of 6. That happens to be the case. We now have correlational evidence, or what is sometimes called observational evidence. Within a given population, the greater the exposure to a wide range of bacteria early on, the lower the incidence of autoimmune disease. If you're still not ready to expose your baby to large amounts of diverse germs, it might influence you to know that there is a fairly plausible hypothesis called the germ exposure theory that could account for the correlational and natural experiment evidence. Early exposure to bacteria could be expected to stimulate the immune system, and such stimulation might have beneficial effects down the road. The young immune system might be strengthened in ways that allow it to adapt and regulate itself, with the result that there is less inflammation and less susceptibility to autoimmune disorders later. Now are you ready to get your baby dirty? Personally, I'm not sure I would be. Natural experiments, correlational evidence, and plausible theories are all well and good. But I would want to see a true experiment of the double-blind randomized control sort, with babies assigned by the proverbial flip of a coin to an experimental high bacteria exposure condition versus a control low bacteria condition. Both the experimenter and the participants, the mothers in this case, should be ignorant of, blind to, the condition the babies were assigned to. Ignorance resulting from this double-blind design rules out the possibility that results could have been influenced by either the experimenters or the participants knowing what condition the participant was in. If it turned out that the experimental high-exposure babies had fewer problems with allergy and asthma, I would be willing to seriously entertain allowing my baby to be exposed to a wide range of bacteria. But I'm not quite sure I would be willing to allow my baby to be a guinea pig in the experiment that might convince me. Fortunately, no one has to volunteer her baby for that experiment. There are such things as experiments with animal models. This is a living animal, phylogenetically close to humans, for which treatments can be presumed to have effects similar to those we would find for humans. Researchers have studied the effects of bacteria exposure in young mice. Instead of exposing some of the mice to extra high levels of bacteria, the scientists went the other direction and created a germ-free environment for some of the mice and left control mice in normal lab mouse conditions, which, trust me, are decidedly not germ-free. The germ-free mice developed abnormal levels of a type of killer T-cell in parts of the colon and in the lungs. These T-cells were subsequently recruited to attack even non-threatening substances, with resulting inflammation, allergy, and asthma. I guess I would now side with the CTV recommendation to let my kid wallow in dirt. Though admittedly, it would make me extremely nervous. And be wary of my advice here. Remember, I'm not a real doctor, as my son occasionally reminds me, but only a PhD. If you decide to expose your infant to extra doses of bacteria, note that such exposure seems to have benefits primarily in the first couple of years of life. So you may not want to continue deliberate exposure to microbes indefinitely. Believe it or not, the week I finished writing those paragraphs, an article appeared in JAMA Pediatrics showing that infant colic, believed by some to be due to irritable bowel syndrome, is greatly alleviated by the administration of 5 drops of a solution containing the bacterium Lactobacillus reuteri. The treatment produces a nearly 50% reduction in infants' colic-related crying. What if your young child does get an infection? Should you follow the doctor's recommendation to give the child an antibiotic? What if you knew that the richer the country, the higher the rate of inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, including Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis? These diseases can be very serious, even fatal. They can cause abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, rectal bleeding, severe internal cramps, anemia, and weight loss. It should raise your suspicions to know that IBDs, like allergy and asthma, are autoimmune diseases. Circumstantial evidence of a correlational nature, to be sure. Surely, wealth per se couldn't cause inflammatory bowel disease. But something associated with wealth could be creating problems. People of a certain age will remember that their childhood was plagued with middle ear infections, whereas their own children, courtesy of amoxicillin, got rid of them almost as soon as they got them. The richer the country, of course, the more likely you are to visit a doctor, to have antibiotics prescribed, and to be able to fill the prescription with insurance money or your own money. But if you're like me, you may have wondered whether it was a great idea to get all those antibiotics, and it looks like I was right to worry. Kids who have lots of ear infections and lots of antibiotics are more likely to develop IBD later in life. Antibiotics are overeager. They kill the good, the bad, and the ugly among the microorganisms in the gut. Antibiotic use, even in adulthood, appears to be associated with subsequent bowel disease. Researchers have found that adults who have IBD are twice as likely to have had multiple antibiotic prescriptions in the previous 2 years. Our evidence is still circumstantial. What's needed is a true experiment. As it happens, the right one exists. If lack of good bacteria is the problem causing IBD, then infusions of good bacteria into the gut, for instance via an enema containing some of the contents of a healthy person's intestines, should be an effective treatment for IBD. Brave scientists and even braver patients tried the experiment. So, Ms. Jones, in this experiment, we're going to pump the contents of a stranger's intestines into yours, and not just because it's never been done, but because there's a possibility it may be good for you. Lucky for both the patients and the scientists, the experiment worked, and treated patients were more likely to improve than were control subjects who received only saline solution. And lucky for you, it's now possible to purchase the helpful intestinal bacteria in pill form. A decision about treating any given childhood disease with antibiotics awaits a lot of research and a thorough cost-benefit analysis, of course. The same goes for infections people develop in adulthood. From natural to proper experiments. Natural experiments can have tremendously important implications that beg to be studied by proper experiments. Children of parents with little education, and who are therefore at risk for low academic achievement themselves, are likely to have a poor elementary school outcome if their first grade teacher, judged by observers, is in the bottom third of teaching effectiveness. If they're lucky enough to get a teacher in the top third of effectiveness, their performance is likely to nearly equal the performance of middle-class children. This finding constitutes a natural experiment. If children were to be randomly assigned to classrooms with teachers of different judged competence, we would have a true experiment. Meanwhile, what parent would be indifferent to teacher effectiveness after hearing about the result of the natural experiment? Greenery in a city is nice. Nicer than you might assume, actually. A study of identical public housing apartment dwellings in Chicago found about half as many reported crimes in apartment houses surrounded by greenery as in apartment houses surrounded by barren land or concrete. In light of the sort of subtle situational cues that can profoundly affect behavior discussed in Chapter 1, this is not such a surprising finding. The study is probably a real experiment because housing officials in Chicago believe that assignments to a particular project are made randomly, and there's no reason to assume that's not correct. On the other hand, lay people don't necessarily mean the same thing by the term random as scientists do, so complete confidence in the greenery low-crime hypothesis awaits a study with verifiably random assignment to dwelling to rule out the possibility that the relationship between greenery and crime is causal and not merely correlational. Obviously, such an experiment is sorely needed. If the true experiment findings duplicate the natural experiment findings, a cost-benefit analysis of the kind discussed in Chapter 4 would be badly needed. Such a study would examine the effects of ripping up concrete and putting in trees and weigh them against the cost in dollars. The analysis might show that the landscape change is a bargain for a city. Scientists often get their ideas when they realize that some observation they've made constitutes a natural experiment. The 18th century physician Edward Jenner noticed that milkmaids rarely got smallpox, a disease related to the cowpox to which the milkmaids would have been exposed. Maybe milkmaids were less likely to get smallpox than butter churners because cowpox somehow protected against smallpox. Jenner found a young milkmaid with cowpox on her hand and inoculated an 8-year-old boy with some material from it. The boy developed a fever and discomfort in his armpits. A few days later, Jenner inoculated the boy with smallpox from a lesion from a smallpox sufferer. The boy did not develop the disease, and Jenner correctly announced that he had discovered a treatment that could prevent smallpox. The Latin word for cow is vacca, and Latin for cowpox is vaccinia, so Jenner called his treatment vaccination. A natural experiment led to a proper experiment, and the results changed the world for the better. Smallpox exists today only in the form of a single virus specimen kept alive in a single laboratory. It's being kept because there would be a need for a source for vaccination material if the disease were to crop up somewhere in the world. The high cost of not doing experiments. We can pay dearly in blood, treasure, and well-being for experiments that aren't done. In the nearly 50 years that Head Start has been in existence, we have spent $200 billion on it. Head Start is a preschool program for poor, primarily minority children, intended to improve their health, academic achievement, and, it was hoped, their IQs. What have we gotten for our investment? The program did improve the children's health, and initially improved IQ and academic success. But the cognitive gains lasted only a few years. By mid-elementary school, the children were doing no better than children who hadn't been in the program. We don't know for sure whether the Head Start children fared any better as adults than did children who weren't in the program. That's because assignment to the program was not random. Kids who ended up in Head Start could have differed in any number of unknown ways from those who didn't attend the program. All the adult outcome data, of which there is shockingly little, rely on purely retrospective information about assignment. People had to remember whether they had been in a preschool program, and if so, which one. Retrospective studies are subject to a great deal of potential error, especially when the memories in question go back to events decades in the past. The retrospective studies do show apparent gains in life outcomes in adulthood for children who were in Head Start, but this result doesn't even come up to the level of a natural experiment, because it would be surprising if there weren't pre-existing differences between children who were in Head Start and those who were not. A lot of money continues to be spent on something that may or may not be effective. Fortunately, as you'll recall from Chapter 4, we know some preschool programs have a huge effect on adult outcomes. Randomized assignment experiments with programs more intensive than Head Start produced modest IQ gains that were long-lasting. But much more important, academic improvements and economic gains for adults who had been in the treatment groups were huge. The costs of not knowing what works and what doesn't in the way of preschool programs have been very great indeed. The $200 billion for Head Start might have been better spent on a smaller number of particularly vulnerable children, providing them with more intensive experiences. That might have produced far greater societal benefits. And we do in fact know that the poorer the child, the greater the impact of high-quality early childhood education. It doesn't seem to much affect outcomes for middle-class children. Moreover, no experiments were conducted to find out what aspects of Head Start, if any, were the most effective. Is it better to focus on academics or on social factors, half days or full days? Are 2 years needed, or would 1 year make almost as much difference? The social and economic consequences of knowing the answers to such questions would be enormous. And getting the answers would have been easy and dirt cheap in comparison to what has been spent. At least it's unlikely that Head Start does any harm to children who participate in it, but many interventions dreamed up by non-scientists actually do harm. Well-intentioned people invented a program to help possible trauma victims soon after a tragedy has occurred. So-called grief counselors encourage participants in a treatment group to recount the incident from their own perspective, describe their emotional responses, offer their comments on others' reactions, and discuss their stress symptoms. The counselor assures participants that their reactions are normal and that such symptoms generally diminish with time. Some 9,000 grief counselors descended on New York City in the wake of 9/11. Grief counseling of this sort seems like an excellent idea to me. However, behavioral scientists have conducted more than a dozen randomized experiments examining critical incident stress debriefing, CISD. they have found no evidence that the activity has a positive effect on depression, anxiety, sleep disturbance, or any other stress symptoms. There is some evidence that people who undergo CISD are more likely to experience full-blown traumatic stress disorder. As it happens, behavioral scientists have found some interventions that actually are effective for trauma victims. A few weeks after a critical incident, the social psychologist James Pennebaker has trauma victims write down, in private, and for 4 nights in a row, their innermost thoughts and feelings about the experience and how it affects their lives. And that's all. No meetings with a counselor, no group therapy encounters, no advice about how to handle the trauma. Just a writing exercise. The experience typically has a very substantial effect on suffering from grief and stress. It's not at all plausible to me that this exercise would be very effective. Certainly not as plausible as the idea that immediate intervention, grief sharing, and advice would be effective. But there it is. Assumptions tend to be wrong. Pennebaker thinks his writing exercise works because it helps people, after a period of suffering and incubation, to develop a narrative to understand the event and their reactions to it. And it seems to be the case that the people who improve most are those who began the exercise with inchoate and disorganized descriptions and ended with coherent, organized narratives that gave meaning to the event. Other well-meaning people have tried to inoculate teenagers against peer pressure to commit crimes and engage in self-destructive behavior, with results that are sometimes even more disappointing than CISD for trauma victims. Decades ago, inmates in Rahway State Prison in New Jersey decided to do something to warn at-risk adolescents of the dire consequences of criminal behavior. The inmates showed the kids what prison was like, including graphic accounts of rape and murder within its walls. An award-winning documentary on the Arts and Entertainment, A&E, channel christened the program Scared Straight. The name and the practice spread widely throughout the United States. Do Scared Straight programs work? 7 experimental tests of the programs have been carried out. Every single study found the Scared Straight kids to be more likely to commit crimes than kids in the control group who were exposed to no intervention at all. On average, the increase in criminal activity was about 13%. The Rahway program still exists, and to this point, more than 50,000 East New Jersey kids have passed through it. Let's multiply 50,000 by 13%. The figure we get is 6,500. That's how many more crimes have been committed than would have been if the well-meaning convicts had never thought up their scheme. And that's just one area of New Jersey. The program has been duplicated in many other communities. A study commissioned by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy estimated that every dollar spent on Scared Straight incurs crime and incarceration costs of more than $200. Why doesn't Scared Straight work? It certainly seems to me that it should. We don't know why it doesn't work, and we certainly don't know why it should be counterproductive, but that doesn't matter. It's a tragedy that it was invented and a crime that it hasn't been stopped. Why hasn't it been stopped? I'll venture the guess that it just seems so obvious that it should work. Many people, including many politicians, prefer to trust their intuitively compelling causal hypotheses over scientific data. It doesn't help that scientists can't offer any convincing explanations for why Scared Straight doesn't work. Scientists, especially social scientists, don't fall into the trap of holding on to their intuitive causal theories in the face of conflicting data, because they are well aware that ATTBW, assumptions tend to be wrong. As of this writing, the A&E channel is still airing a program singing the praises of Scared Straight. DARE is another elaborate attempt to keep kids out of trouble. As part of the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program, local police officers undergo 80 hours of training and teaching techniques and then visit classrooms to present information intended to reduce drug, alcohol, and tobacco use. It's been funded by state, local, and federal government sources to the tune of $1 billion per year. According to DARE's website, 75% of American school districts participate in the program, as well as 43 countries. But in fact, DARE, as it has been conducted for the past 30 years at least, doesn't decrease children's use of drugs. DARE doesn't admit the ineffectiveness of its programs and actively combats critics who present scientific evidence for its failures. Programs intended by DARE to supplement or replace the original have not been thoroughly evaluated by external institutions to this point. Why doesn't DARE work? We don't know. It would be nice if we did, but causal explanations are unnecessary. As it happens, some programs intended to lower the likelihood of drug, alcohol, and tobacco use do work. These include life skills training and the Midwestern Prevention Project. These programs have elements missing from the original DARE program, notably teaching pre-adolescent skills and resisting peer pressure. The inventors of DARE made the assumption that police are important social influence agents for teenagers. A social psychologist could have told them that peers are a much more effective source of influence. The more successful programs also provide information about drug and alcohol use among teenagers and adults. Recall that such information often surprises because these rates are lower than most youngsters believe, and accurate knowledge about others' behavior can lower rates of abuse. Meanwhile, programs that damage young people are still being conducted, and programs that help are underused or used not at all. Society is paying a high price in dollars and human suffering for wrong assumptions. Summing up, sometimes we can observe relationships that come close to being as convincing as a genuine experiment. People whose childhoods were spent in circumstances that would have resulted in relatively great exposure to bacteria are less prone to some autoimmune diseases. When this is found across a large number of quite different circumstances, hygienic versus less hygienic countries, farms versus cities, pets versus no pets, vaginal versus cesarean birth, and so on, the observations begin to be very suggestive. Such observations led scientists to conduct actual experiments that established that early exposure to bacteria does, in fact, reduce the likelihood of autoimmune diseases. The randomized control experiment is frequently called the gold standard in scientific and medical research, with good reason. Results from such studies trump results from any and all other kinds of studies. Randomized assignment ensures that there are no differences in any variable between experimental and control cases prior to the manipulation of the independent variable. Any difference found between them can usually be assumed to be due only to the scientist's intervention. Double-blind randomized control experiments are those where neither the researcher nor the patient knows what condition the patient is in. This type of experiment establishes that only the intervention, and not something about the patient's or doctor's knowledge of the intervention, could have produced the results. Society pays a high cost for experiments not carried out. Because of failure to carry out randomized experiments, we don't know whether the $200 billion paid for Head Start was effective in improving cognitive abilities or not. Because of randomized control experiments, we do know that some high-quality pre-K programs are enormously effective, resulting in adults who function in much healthier and more effective ways. Proper experiments on pre-K techniques stand a chance of resulting in huge cost savings and great benefits to individuals and society. DARE programs don't produce less teen drug or alcohol use. Scared straight programs result in more crime, not less. And grief counselors may be in the business of increasing grief rather than reducing it. Unfortunately, in many domains, society has no means of ensuring that interventions are always tested by experiment, and no way of guaranteeing that public policy must take into account the results of experiments that are carried out. Chapter 11. Economics. Do auto salespeople offer deals to women that are more expensive than the deals they offer to men? Does classroom size affect learning? Are multivitamins good for your health? Is there employer prejudice against the long-term unemployed simply because they've been out of a job for a long time? Should postmenopausal women take hormone replacement therapy to reduce the likelihood of cardiovascular disease? Many answers to each of these questions have been proposed. Some answers were based on studies that reached incorrect conclusions because of faulty methodology. Some answers are quite likely correct because good scientific methodology was used. This chapter makes three points that are crucial to understanding scientific findings and deciding whether to believe them. 1. Studies that rely on correlations to establish a scientific fact can be hopelessly misleading, even when the correlations come in complicated packages called multiple regression analysis that control for a host of variables. 2. Experiments in which people, or objects of any kind, are assigned randomly to one treatment versus another, or no treatment at all, are in general far superior to research based on multiple regression analysis. 3. Assumptions are so often wrong when it comes to human behavior that it's essential to conduct experiments, if at all possible, to test any hypothesis about behavior that matters. Multiple regression analysis. All the questions that began this chapter ask whether some independent or predictor variable, an input or a presumed cause, affects some dependent or outcome variable, an output or an effect. Experiments manipulate independent variables. Correlational analyses merely measure independent variables. One technique employing correlational analysis is multiple regression analysis, MRA, in which a number of independent variables are correlated simultaneously, or sometimes sequentially, but we won't talk about that variant of MRA, with some dependent variable. Footnote: the term regression is a little confusing because regression to the mean seems to be a very different thing than examining the relation between a set of independent variables and a dependent variable. The reason the same word is used for such different purposes appears to be that Carl Pearson, the inventor of the correlation technique that bears his name, first used that method to examine the correlation between related individuals for some variable. The correlation between the heights of fathers and sons always shows a regression to the mean. Unusually tall fathers have somewhat shorter sons on average. Unusually short fathers have somewhat taller sons on average. A correlation is a simple regression analysis relating one variable to another. Multiple regression examines the relation of each of a set of variables to another variable. End footnote. The predictor variable of interest is examined along with other independent variables that are referred to as control variables. The goal is to show that variable A influences variable B net of the effects of all the other variables. That is to say, the relationship holds even when the effects of the control variables on the dependent variable are taken into account. Consider this example. Smoking cigarettes is correlated with higher incidence of cardiovascular disease. The temptation is to say it looks as if smoking causes cardiovascular disease. The problem is that lots of other things are correlated both with smoking and with cardiovascular disease, such as age, social class, and excess weight. Older smokers have smoked for a longer time than younger smokers, so we need to pull age out of the smoking disease correlation. Otherwise, what we're showing is that being older and smoking are associated with cardiovascular disease. But that conflates two variables. What we want to know is just the association between smoking and cardiovascular disease, regardless of how old a person is. We control for age effects on cardiovascular disease by removing the age-disease correlation from the smoking-disease correlation. The result is that we can now say, in effect, that the association between smoking and cardiovascular disease is found for every age group. The same logic applies to social class. Other things being equal, the lower the social class, the greater the likelihood of smoking, and the lower the social class, the greater the risk of cardiovascular disease, independent of any risk factor such as smoking. Ditto for excess weight, and so on. The correlations of these variables with both smoking and degree of cardiovascular disease have to be pulled out of the correlation between smoking and cardiovascular disease. The theory behind multiple regression analysis is that if you control for everything that is related to the independent variable and the dependent variable by pulling their correlations out of the mix, you can get at the true causal relation between the predictor variable and the outcome variable. That's the theory. In practice, many things prevent this ideal case from being the norm. First of all, how do we know we've identified all of the possible confounds, the variables linked to both the predictor and outcome variables? We're almost never able to make that claim. We can only measure what we assume might be important and leave out the infinity of variables that we don't assume are important. But ATTBW, assumptions tend to be wrong. So the battle is usually lost right there. Second, how well do we measure each of the possible confounding variables? If we measure a variable poorly, we haven't controlled for it enough. If we measure a variable so poorly that it has no validity, we haven't controlled for anything. Sometimes MRA is the only research tool available for examining interesting and important questions. An example is the question of whether religious belief and practice are associated with greater or lesser rates of procreation. We can't do an experiment to test that question, randomly assigning people to be religious or not. We can only use correlational methods such as MRA. As it happens, religiosity is correlated with fecundity at both the individual level and the national or cultural level. Controlling for income, age, health status, and other factors at the level of individuals, at the level of ethnic groups, and at the level of countries, greater religiosity is correlated with greater fecundity. Just why this is, we don't know. And the correlation between religiosity and fecundity might not be causal at all, but rather could be due to the fact that some unmeasured third variable influences both religiosity and fecundity. Causality could even run in the reverse direction. Having lots of children might make people search for divine support and guidance. The correlational finding is interesting nonetheless, and knowing about it might have real-world consequences. I want to be very clear that not all correlational research or all multiple regression research is valueless. I've often used multiple regression myself, even when I've conducted experiments establishing a causal relationship. I feel more comfortable knowing that a given relationship exists in the wild and not just in the laboratory or in a possibly atypical ecological environment. Moreover, there are often clever things that one can do to make us pretty sure that we've learned something about causality. Take the correlation between the wealth of nations and the IQ of nations. What's going on causally there? The correlation taken by itself is hugely problematic. Lots of things are correlated with both wealth and IQ. Physical health, for example. Healthy, wealthy, and wise, it's not just an expression. The three go together in a bundle of correlations that include many other potential causal variables as well. Moreover, there's a plausible causal story running in both directions. As a nation gets smarter, it gets richer, because more advanced and complex ways of making a living become possible. As a nation gets richer, it gets smarter, because wealth generally increases the quality of education. But we can sometimes tell a pretty good causal story by looking at what are called lagged correlations. That is, the correlation of an independent variable, assumed cause, with another variable, assumed outcome of the cause, at a later time. If a nation gets smarter because of an increase in education, for example, does it get richer down the road? Indeed, it does. For example, a few decades ago, Ireland made a concerted and highly successful effort to improve its educational system, especially at the high school, vocational school, and college levels. College attendance actually increased by 50% over a brief period of time. Within about 30 years, the per capita GDP of Ireland, which previously had IQ scores far lower than that of England, for genetic reasons according to some English psychologists, had exceeded the per capita GDP of England. Finland also made significant educational improvements beginning several decades ago, focusing especially on making sure the poorest students got an education as equal as possible to that of the richest students. By 2010, Finland was ahead of every country on international tests of academic achievement, and its per capita income had risen to be greater than that of Japan and Britain, and only slightly less than that of the United States. Nations that have not made heroic efforts to improve education in recent decades, such as the United States, have declined in per capita income relative to other advanced countries. Such data are still correlational, but they indicate that as a nation begins to break out of the pack educationally, it begins to get richer. As it stagnates educationally, it begins to lose wealth relative to other nations. Pretty persuasive. Many other circumstances can pull correlational research up to a level of convincingness equal to natural experiments or even randomized control experiments. For example, sheer magnitude of an effect can sometimes make us feel that it must not be a mere artifact due to correlated variables. We also become somewhat more confident that a given treatment is real if the effect is dose-dependent. That is, the more intense or frequent the treatment, the higher the level of response. For example, people who smoke 2 packs a day are much more likely to have poor cardiovascular function than people who smoke 6 cigarettes a day. This makes it more likely that smoking really does worsen cardiovascular health than if it were the case that the sheer amount of smoking is unrelated to morbidity. But there are serious problems with multiple regression analysis, as it's all too frequently conducted. I'm going to be very explicit about the problems because the media constantly report findings based on this highly fallible method, and important policy decisions are made on the basis of them. Epidemiologists, medical researchers, sociologists, psychologists, and economists all use this technique. It can produce serious errors, and the claims of some devotees that it can reveal causality are usually bogus. In many instances, MRA gives one impression about causality, and actual randomized control experiments give another. In such cases, we should believe in the results of the experiments. Would you think the number of children in a classroom matters for how well school children learn? It seems reasonable that it would. But dozens of MRA studies by highly regarded investigators tell us that net of average income of families in the school district, size of the school, IQ test performance, city size, and geographic location, average class size is uncorrelated with student performance. The implication? We now know we needn't waste money on decreasing the size of classes. But scientists in Tennessee conducted a randomized experiment in which they varied class size substantially. By the flip of a coin, researchers assigned children in kindergarten through third grade to either small classes, 13 to 17, or larger classes, 22 to 25. The study found that smaller classes produced about a 0.22 SD improvement in standardized test performance. The effect on minority children was greater than the effect on white children. There are now 3 other experimental studies of the effects of reduction of class size, and their findings are almost identical to those of the Tennessee study. These 4 experiments are not merely additional studies on the effects of class size. They replace all the multiple regression studies of class size. That's because we have greater confidence in experimental results for a question like this. Why do the multiple regression studies find that class size matters so little? I don't know. But we don't have to know in order to have a strong opinion about whether class size can matter. There's a lot that the 4 experiments leave unanswered, of course. We don't know whether class size makes a difference for every region of the country, every degree of urbanization, every level of social class, and so on. We don't know what's going on in classrooms that produces the different educational effects. But those questions can be answered by further experiments, and positive findings for each experiment looking at populations that differ in notable ways from those examined in the available studies would increase our confidence that larger class size does indeed make a difference. Whether decreasing the size of classes is the best thing to spend the educational dollar on is a separate question, and an answer to it is above my pay grade. Finland doesn't have particularly small classes. The improved educational outcome was more likely a result of paying teachers more and recruiting them primarily from the top of their college classes rather than the bottom, as the United States now does. And in any case, policy can't be determined simply by finding a beneficial effect of X on Y. A full dress cost-benefit analysis is required. The problem with correlational studies, such as those based on MRA, is that they are, by definition, susceptible to errors based on self-selection. Cases, people, classrooms, agricultural plots differ in any number of ways. Long-time smokers aren't just long-time smokers. They've dragged along lots of other factors associated with smoking, such as greater age, lower social class, and excess weight. Classroom A is larger than classroom B, but it also differs in any number of ways over which the investigator has no control. Classroom A may have a better teacher because the principal thought that teacher could handle large-sized classes better than other teachers in the school. Classroom B may have high achievement scores, even though it has a large number of students, because the principal thought that more able students would suffer less from relative lack of attention than less able students, and so on. The problem doesn't get solved simply by adding more classrooms or more control variables into the mix. In studies where cases are randomly assigned to an experimental condition, the variability among classrooms on other dimensions remains. But, critically, it's the experimenter who selects the condition. This means that the experimental classrooms and the control classrooms have equally good teachers on average, equally able and motivated students, and equal resources. The classrooms have not selected their own level on each of these variables. The experimenter has. Thus, the only thing that differs between experimental and control classrooms on average is the variable of interest, namely class size. Experiments like those on class size are not conclusive. Neither teachers nor administrators, for example, are blind to condition. They know which classes are small and which are large, and this might affect how teachers teach, including how much effort they put into the job. It's just that such problems pale in significance to the self-selection problem. Medical models. Did you know that consuming large amounts of olive oil can reduce your risk of stroke by 41%? Did you know that if you have cataracts and get them operated on, your mortality risk is lowered by 40% over the next 15 years compared to people with cataracts who don't get them operated on? Did you know that deafness causes dementia? Did you know that being suspicious of other people causes dementia? If those claims sound dubious to you, they should. But alleged findings such as these appear constantly in the media. They're typically based on epidemiological studies. Epidemiology is the study of disease patterns in populations and their causes. A great deal of epidemiological research relies on MRA. Studies using it attempt to control for factors such as social class, age, and prior state of health. But they can't get around the self-selection problem. The sorts of people who get a given medical treatment, or who consume large amounts of a particular food, or who take a particular vitamin, differ from those who don't get the treatment, don't consume the food, or don't take the vitamin, in goodness knows how many ways. Let's look at the study claiming that net of control factors including socio-demographic variables, physical activity, body mass index, and risk factors for stroke, people who consume more olive oil have fewer strokes. The reduction in one study was 41% for intensive users of olive oil versus those who never used it. But it might not be olive oil consumption that reduces mortality, but something correlated with olive oil consumption. For starters, take ethnicity. Italian Americans are big olive oil users, and African Americans almost surely are not. And the life expectancy of Italian Americans is significantly greater than for blacks, who incidentally are particularly prone to have strokes. The biggest potential confound in any epidemiological study is typically social class. Class is a glaringly obvious candidate for affecting differences in risk for stroke and many, if not most, other medical outcomes. The rich are different from us. They have more money. People with more money can afford to use olive oil rather than corn oil. People with more money are also more likely to be widely read and associate with other readers and therefore to believe that olive oil is better for one's health than its cheaper competitors. People with more money get better medical care. And people with more money and with higher social class, whether you measure class by education, personal income, or occupational status, have better life outcomes of all kinds. A failure to control for social class in an epidemiological study is fatal to any attempt to infer the cause of a given medical outcome. But supposing the investigator does try to measure social class, how should it be done? Some use income, some use education, some use occupation. Which is best? Or should you somehow combine the three? The truth is that different epidemiological studies may try to measure social class in any or all or none of these ways. And that contributes to the constant churning of medical findings reported by the media. Fat is bad for you. No, fat is good for you. Red meat is good for you. No, red meat is bad for you. Antihistamines reduce the severity of the common cold. No, antihistamines have no effect. The differing results are frequently just the consequence of defining social class differently or of not examining it at all. But social class is only one of an unlimited number of potential confounds present in MRA studies. Almost anything that's correlated with both the predictor variable and the outcome variable in such studies becomes a candidate for explaining the correlation between the two. There are thousands of food supplements on the market. MRA studies sometimes find that one or another supplement is beneficial for one thing or another. The media then pass along that finding. Unfortunately, there is usually no way for the reader to tell whether a given study is based on MRA, in which case you probably shouldn't pay much attention to it, or an actual experiment, in which case it may be very important indeed for you to pay attention. Reporters, even those who specialize in health reporting, typically don't fully understand the crucial difference between the two methodologies. There are countless examples of MRA studies finding one thing and experiments finding another. For example, MRA studies report that vitamin E supplements reduce the likelihood of prostate cancer. By contrast, an experimental study was conducted at many locations in the United States, assigning at random some men to vitamin E supplements and others to a placebo. This experiment found a slight increase in the likelihood of cancer. MRA studies report that vitamin E supplements reduce the likelihood of prostate cancer. By contrast, an experimental study was conducted at many locations in the United States, assigning at random some men to vitamin E supplements and others to a placebo. This experiment found a slight increase in the likelihood of cancer by virtue of taking vitamin E. Vitamin E is not the only suspect supplement. There are a host of experimental studies showing that taking multivitamins, something that almost half of Americans do, does little or no good, and very high doses of some vitamins can do genuine harm. There is almost no evidence one way or another about the effects of any of the other 50,000 or so food supplements that are on the market. Most of the evidence we do have about any given supplement indicates that it's useless. Some indicates it's actually harmful. Unfortunately, lobbying by the supplement industry resulted in Congress exempting supplements from federal regulation, including any requirement that manufacturers do experimental studies of actual effectiveness. As a consequence, billions of dollars are spent every year on nostrums that are useless or worse. Using multiple regression analysis when only experiments can do the job. The longer a person is unemployed, the harder it is to find a job. As of this writing, the number of people who have been unemployed just for a short time, 14 weeks or less, is only slightly more than it was just before the Great Recession hit. But the number of long-term unemployed is 200% higher than it was then. Is there prejudice against the long-time unemployed on the part of employers? Are they not given consideration simply because they've been out of a job for a long time? MRA can't tell us whether, other things being equal, employers unjustifiably pass over the long-time unemployed in favor of the briefly unemployed. The long-term unemployed may have poor employment records, or be lackadaisical in job hunting, or be too picky about the kind of job they would do. Politicians routinely invoked these alleged causes during the Great Recession. But you can't know whether these explanations are correct by conducting a multiple regression analysis. No amount of controlling for such variables will get rid of self-selection bias and tell you whether there is hiring prejudice. The only way to answer the question is with an experiment. And the experiment has been done. We know the answer. The economists Rand Guyad and William Dickens sent out 4,800 fictitious applications for 600 job openings. Even when applications were identical, except for alleged length of unemployment, the short-term unemployed were twice as likely to get an interview as the long-term unemployed. In fact, the short-term unemployed were more likely to get an interview for a job for which they were not very well qualified than were long-term unemployed people who were more fully qualified. There are questions that can only be handled by an experiment, but which some scientists nonetheless feel are better answered by multiple regression analysis. Many experimental studies have shown that African-American job applicants with black-sounding names, DeAndre, Lakeisha, are less likely to get interviews than identical applicants with names that don't sound black, Donald, Linda. Applicants with white-sounding names have as much as a 50% greater likelihood of being granted an interview than applicants with black-sounding names. Having a white-sounding name rather than a black-sounding name is worth as much as 8 years of job experience. Being dubious about whether black names actually produce worse economic outcomes, the highly respected economists Roland Fryer and Stephen Levitt conducted a multiple regression study examining the relationship between having a black-sounding name and various economic outcomes. The population they studied consisted of black women born to non-Hispanic blacks in California who had remained in the state as adults. The dependent variables were not job hunting success or income or occupational status, but indirect measures of life outcomes, such as average income in the woman's zip code and whether the woman had private health insurance. The investigators report that the latter variable is the best measure we have with respect to the quality of her current employment. The best that the investigators had, that is. It's really a rather crude measure of occupational attainment. Fryer and Levitt found that women with black-sounding names fare substantially worse on their indicators of occupational success than people with white-sounding names, as we would expect based on the experimental studies. But the relationship between type of name and the outcome variables vanished when they controlled for variables such as percent of black babies in the hospital of the woman's birth, percent of black babies in the county of her birth, whether the mother was born in California, mother's age at time of birth, father's age at time of birth, months of prenatal care, whether the woman was born in a county hospital, her birth weight, her total number of children, and whether she was a single mother. The authors were aware of the problems with this kind of analysis. They acknowledged that the clear weakness of this empirical approach is that if unobserved characteristics of the woman are correlated both with life outcomes and her name, our estimates will be biased. Indeed. Nevertheless, the authors go on to state that there is no connection between how black-sounding one's name is and life outcomes after they control for other factors. We find no negative relationship between having a distinctively black name and later life outcomes after controlling for a child's circumstances at birth. A very large number of variables, many of which would be more predictive of occupational success than the ones Fryer and Levitt examined, would have to have been assessed in order to justify that conclusion. And when very large numbers of control variables are examined, many of them having stronger relationships with the dependent variable than the correlation of most interest, conclusions become shaky. Fryer and Levitt imply that parents can give their child a black-sounding name without worrying that there might be negative effects on occupational success. That seems extraordinarily unlikely in light of the experimental studies. A recent study by Catherine Milkman and her colleagues shows that a black-sounding name can surely disadvantage candidates for graduate school. Thousands of professors were sent an email message, allegedly from a prospective graduate student, requesting a meeting a week hence to discuss research opportunities. A male student with a white-sounding name was 12% more likely to be granted the interview than a male student with a black-sounding name. Such a difference could have real consequences. Getting one's first choice for graduate advisor versus not can mean a distinguished career versus a less distinguished one. Why might Fryer and Levitt have been willing to assume that an MRA study could be powerful and accurate enough to cast doubt on the implications of the experimental studies? I suspect it's because of what the French call déformation professionnelle, the tendency to adopt the tools and point of view of people who share one's profession. For many of the types of research that economists do, MRA is the only available option. Economists can't manipulate interest rates set by the Federal Reserve. If you want to find out whether austerity or pump priming was more helpful to a country's economy during the Great Recession, you can correlate degree of austerity with strength of recovery. But you can't randomly assign countries to an austerity condition. Economists are taught MRA as their main statistical tool. but they are not taught to be nearly as critical of it as they need to be. Levitt, in a book co-written with the journalist Stephen Dubner, reported on an analysis of data collected by the U.S. Department of Education called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study. The academic achievement of students from kindergarten to fifth grade was examined, along with dozens of other variables such as parental income and education, how many books were in the child's home, how much the child was read to, whether the child was adopted, and so forth. Levitt reports on the MRA-based conclusions about the relationship between a host of these variables and academic achievement. He concludes that net of many variables, including number of books in the home, reading books doesn't have an impact on early childhood test scores. MRA simply isn't up to the job of establishing that reading to children is unimportant for their intellectual development. Only an experiment could do that. Levitt had an additional finding indicating that net of many variables, including reading books to children, having books in the home has an important effect on test scores. Thus, owning lots of books makes children smarter, but reading those books to them doesn't. Levitt's faith in MRA is such that he actually attempts to give a causal explanation for this state of affairs. A much more important error is Levitt's assertion that family environment has relatively little effect on children's intellectual skills. He bases this conclusion on studies of adoptive children. Studies have shown that a child's academic abilities are far more influenced by the IQs of his biological parents than the IQs of his adoptive parents. But correlations are the wrong data to look at to reach an estimate of the importance of family environment. We need to look instead at the results of the natural experiment of adoption of a child versus leaving the child with the birth parents, who typically are of much lower socioeconomic status. The environments created by adoptive parents are substantially more favorable in many respects than those of families in general. And in fact, the school performance of adopted children is half a standard deviation higher than that of siblings who were not adopted. The IQs of adopted children are more than a standard deviation higher than non-adopted siblings. And the higher the social class of the adoptive parents, and therefore the more favorable the intellectual environment on average, the higher the IQ of the adopted child. The effects of family environment on intellectual skills are actually very great. In Levitt's defense, he didn't come up with his mistaken conclusions about the effect of adoptive environments on his own. Behavioral scientists and geneticists have been using the correlational data to reach wrong conclusions about environmental effects on intellectual ability for decades. Some eminent economists don't seem to recognize the value of experiments at all. The economist Jeffrey Sachs started an extremely ambitious program of health, agricultural, and educational interventions in a small number of African villages with the intent of improving quality of life. The program's cost is very high relative to alternatives, and it has been severely criticized by other development experts. Though some of Sachs's villages improved their residents' conditions, similar villages in Africa improved more without his intervention. Sachs could have ended the criticism by randomly assigning similar villages to his treatment condition versus no treatment, and showing that his villages made better progress than those control villages. Sachs has refused to conduct this experiment on what he described as ethical grounds. What's unethical is not to conduct experiments when they're feasible. Sachs spent a great deal of other people's money, but we have no idea whether that money improved people's lives more than alternative, possibly less expensive programs would have. As it happens, though, increasing numbers of economists are conducting social psychology-type randomized control experiments. One recent example is a particularly impressive series of experiments conducted by the economist Sendhil Mulinathan and the psychologist Eldar Shafir, showing that resource scarcity can have dire consequences for the cognitive functioning of everyone from farmers to CEOs. If you ask people to imagine how they would rejigger their budgets if they suddenly were confronted with the need for an auto repair costing several thousand dollars, and then give them an IQ test, you will find that the IQ of poor people takes a big beating. Well-off people's IQ is unaffected by this thought exercise, and contemplation of an auto repair of a few hundred dollars doesn't impair the test performance of either poor people or well-off people. The economist Raj Chetty is a leader in pushing economists toward finding natural experiments that test economic hypotheses. Does teacher quality really matter in the long run? We can estimate how